to take a few questions. After extraordinary debate and negotiation, we have reached an agreement with the Senate Republican and Democratic leaders on a civil rights bill that would be a source of pride for all Americans. It does not resort to quotas, and it strengthens the cause of equality in the workplace. Both the administration and the Congress can present this legislation to the people of America as a new standard against discrimination and for equal opportunity. This agreement was reached last night in marathon negotiations, shepherded by Senator John Danforth of Missouri, nurtured by Senator Dole and other leaders of both parties. It was a proud accomplishment for the Congress and the administration. And now we can go forward together in progress on civil rights in this country. I remember standing out there in the Rose Garden with Attorney General Thornburg more than a year and a half ago to make an unshakable commitment to the nation's civil rights leaders that I wanted a non-quota civil rights bill that I could sign. And assuming there are no changes in the bill as agreed to last night, we now have such a bill. And my promise will be kept, and I will enthusiastically sign this bill. Another subject on the Middle East Peace Conference. I want to note the historic nature of this meeting. In Middle East has been characterized by dangerous and tragic conflict for decades. The peoples of this region still have enormous differences, but I want to commend the statesmanship of the leaders of all those parties attending the peace conference. Sitting down together is the beginning of understanding, and we cannot know the outcome, of course. It'll take patience and determination. The United States cannot make peace in the Middle East. Only the parties themselves can do that. But we can and will be a committed and active partner in the search for peace. Secretary Baker has been patient. He's been steadfast. He's tirelessly disciplined in working with the Soviet Union and all the parties in the region to make this conference and the promise of peace a reality. We owe him a major debt of thanks. I also go to Madrid to meet with President Gorbachev, and I know that President Gorbachev joins me in wanting to put the hopes and aspirations of all the world behind these new opportunities for peace. So, thank you very much, and now I'll be glad to take a few questions. Lori?
Mr. President, on the domestic arena, the American economy is going to increase the number of people. Millions are out of work, and it seems almost daily statistics are pouring in making it look like there might be another recession. Aren't signs clear that some kind of action is needed, and what would you tell Americans you will do?
I don't want to buy into the predicate about another recession. I don't feel that way. The economy has been sluggish. It hasn't been near as good as I would like to see it, or certainly the American people would like to see it. What would I like to do about it? I'd like to see the Congress take the action that I've proposed way back starting in 89 and have continued to propose on growth. We need some stimulation to economic growth. And I think everybody is now familiar with the fact that I think capital gains cut would stimulate growth and create jobs and create opportunity. And we get assailed as this is a tax break for the rich. I'd like to propose to Congress, let's try it. And I'll take all the blame on the political side, and then give me only half the credit on what good that would do for the economy. We've also had a program that includes enhanced R&D. We've got banking reform legislation that would clearly be stimulative in terms of loaning. It's hung up in the Capitol. We put forward a program related to IRAs. We got a transportation bill that is job intensive. We put forward for the most heavily adversely affected areas, enterprise zones. Now there's a good 6-point growth package for you, and the Congress has refused to do one single thing about it. And I don't think there is one person out across this country that is in doubt that we are for these things. So we will see where we go from here, but I am concerned. When people are hurting, of course you're concerned about it. And I'd like to see an unemployment benefits package that includes pay as you go. That doesn't add to the deficit on the burden of future generations with more federal deficit. Make it work within the budget agreement. That's what I've proposed, and by standing firm, I hope Congress will now send me such a package.
Some Republicans on the Hill have indicated a willingness to go along with Democratic tax cuts for the middle income.
I'd be so enthusiastic about a tax cut for all Americans, but I want it to be done. It can't be done and still live within the budget agreement. I'm enthusiastic about that. But it has to be, if there's going to be anything new of that nature, it's got to be that and then figuring out how to have it within the budget agreement. And I prefer to emphasize these things: capital gains reduction, R&D, bank reform, IRA, transportation bill, enterprise zones, the thing I have said. But I'm not going to be totally opposed to some of these ideas I hear up there. But let them consider our growth package. That's what I'd start with. And then if there's some other merits, fine. But let's do it without busting the budget agreement and then saying federal debt doesn't matter. It does matter. Deficits matter. Yeah.
Mr. President, Prime Minister Shamir will lead Israel's delegation to Madrid. As recently as yesterday, he said there would be no territorial concessions to Arab states, no freeze on Israeli settlements. Can there be any progress in Madrid and afterward if that's his stand?
Terry, I knew somebody was going to ask these questions, of the detailed questions about stated position of participants in the conference. It is most understandable. I'm not going to reply to them. What I do not want to do is inadvertently complicate the process. Let the parties sit down as they plan to do and discuss these one priority or another. It is not for the United States to do that. Our positions are known on 242 and 338. Our positions are known on a lot of other subjects that'll probably be discussed there. But we're trying to be a catalyst to bring people together and let them talk about the differences. So I'm sorry, I'm not going to respond definitively to this question, nor to others about the specific issues that divide the parties. We're not trying to impose a settlement. We're trying to bring people together so they can achieve a settlement.
Will you outline the U.S. issue or the U.S. stand, though, when you open
it? I don't think we need to do that at this juncture. The United States positions are clear. But it isn't a question. We're not having a conference about U.S. policy. We're having a conference about bringing people together to settle age-old disputes.
Will you see Mr. Shamir?
Yes, I certainly will, and I'll see other delegation heads, and I'll see President Gorbachev, and I hope to see the Prime Minister of Spain and the ruling monarch, the King of Spain. So I'll have, I don't know how many bilateral meetings, that hasn't been set up, but clearly I will. Look forward to it. Yes.
Sir, may I give you an outline, a scenario that may have happened on the civil rights state of the last couple of days, and you tell me what's wrong with it. Wednesday afternoon, you had some Republican senators over here, and you and Boyd and Wade passed out a piece of paper stating some objections to Senator Danforth's bill. And these Republican senators put back the bill to conservatives who normally would want to side with you, and they found out that the White House had misrepresented Senator Danforth's bill. They went ballistic, said you could no longer hold the line, the 34 motions that vetoed the civil rights bill in Spain, and at that point you decided you had to compromise and you basically caved.
Wrong. It's just wrong, that's all. Next question. Just wrong. We didn't cave. We worked out in a spirit of compromise a negotiated settlement where I can say to the American people, this is not a quota bill. There was give and take on a lot of issues, and you're just putting a political spin on it that is 100% wrong.
Were you confident you had the votes to sustain the veto? You were confident all the way.
Absolutely. We've been dealing from that position. We didn't have the votes to carry my civil rights bill. So have we compromised some? Yeah. In fact, I'm going to ask Boyden to answer the specific questions that on you know, where the give and take was here after I finished, because it's highly technical, believe me. And with all respect, I'm not sure everybody will understand it after he explains it. But it is very technical, and all I know is I can simply certify it is not a quota bill, it is a fair bill, and it's going to hit a lick against discrimination in the workplace, and I couldn't be more happy. In fact, we just heard from Senator Kennedy that says it's going to have, he believes that a large number of Democrats will go along with it too. So I've said I wanted a civil rights bill. I said I didn't want a quota bill. We have a civil rights bill. It is not a quota bill. And I couldn't be happier because I have not liked, may I finish, I have not liked these characterizations that I really didn't want a civil rights bill. I've wanted it all along. I think many people here know that because I've said it all the time, but I don't think the American people necessarily did. That's why it's a joyous day. Yeah, we're coming right across.
The civil rights bill that you do have caps damages in sex discrimination cases, but not in cases of racial discrimination. Understanding that this is the first time any monetary damages have been allowed for sexual discrimination cases. Nonetheless, how do you justify that to women who may see it as an indication that the sexual discrimination cases just aren't taken as seriously as racial discrimination?
I just would try to dispel that notion and say, look, the main thing is to get a civil rights bill that hits against sex harassment and hits against discrimination in the workplace. So that's the way I'd answer it. And this is the first. This is an historic first. Let me refer you to the lawyer.
Mr. President, back to the Thomas hearings. In view of the force of his unvarnished testimony during the 11th hour hearing, sir, I wondered if, which many people I think believe saved his nomination, I wondered if you reconsidered the wisdom of placing nominees at the disposal of White House handlers whose job seems to be to shave all the rough edges off their positions and to prevent them from saying anything that might be controversial.
I heard this question before. Not since Sunday. I think when you talk about White House handlers positioning everybody, you do a disservice to the nominees. Yes, a person that's being thrown up into the confirmation process welcomes advice and counsel. But I think if one suggests that a nominee is going to do exactly what handlers are alleged to want to happen, I think it's wrong. So I don't think that, I think the way that question comes out does a disservice to Judge Thomas, who set his own pattern. Yes, he was helped by various people. There were certain questions that they were said, well, you might get this question or that. How do you think that one should be replied to? Fine. But I think it demeans him to suggest that handlers are telling everybody what to say or not to say. There's a pattern in these confirmation hearings about who gets asked what question, who doesn't. I believe that he was asked over and over again more questions on a subject or another than his predecessors.
Well, Mr. President, though, Thomas himself said before he delivered his statement on Friday that it was not the product, as he put it, of any handler. So surely if he recognized that handlers had had a role in his testimony beforehand, don't you?
Well, I'm not saying there weren't people trying to help. I don't like the word handlers, like the prize fighter. Okay, go in there and slug them again. I mean, that's not what this is all about.
Well, we're talking.
Maybe I'm missing your question, Brett.
We're talking here, sir, about people who, when they're not doing this, are lobbying on behalf of various private interests who need to maintain good relationships, understandably, with Capitol Hill, and whose participation in a situation like this is a bit of a conflict of interest in the sense that they don't want to alienate anybody and they don't want the nominee to.
Well, you see, if you suggest that. If the question suggests that a nominee, in this instance Judge Thomas, would compromise principles because of some person trying to help him not wanting to alienate Congress, I would just reject that. I don't think it's an intellectually fair charge to level against him is the way I'd handle it. Yeah.
Mr. President, Colin Powell apparently feels the Pentagon can live with half the 75 B-2 stealth bombers that you have proposed. Do you agree? And if so, how will you keep opponents of the program from chipping away at the lower number?
Well, we have a program. It's up there. And we will be discussing a wide array of defense matters as we go forward now. And I'm not going to, I don't want to take a position on one key player's alleged position and compare it to how somebody else in the administration feels. I will have something to say as we go along each step of the way as to administration position and not permit myself to be drawn into debating what one key player says over what another key player might feel. So I can't help you on it. I'm just not familiar either with Colin's latest comments on that?
It sounds like there's some give in your position, Robert. So you're not rigid on the 75.
Well, I wouldn't say that. We've got a proposal up there, and let's see where we go with it. Yeah.
Mr. President, when you signed the budget agreement with Congress, the economy was not known to be in a recession. The Soviet Union had not collapsed, and therefore you had not ordered a cutback in the nation's nuclear arsenal, and estimates hadn't come out that the U.S. could live with a much smaller defense force. Why not revisit the budget agreement in light of all this and in light of the fact that the budget deficit is going to be higher than the agreement called for anyway?
I will not revisit it because it's the only cap we have on outrageous congressional spending. It's the only way you control the excesses of spending. It is the only guarantor that the guarantee that the taxpayer has that his interest to some degree will be protected. And if you revisit it in the sense of removing these constraints, the spending gates would open. We've already seen it on some legislation. The unemployment benefits is a good recent example. Don't worry about budget deficits. Don't worry about those people that are paying the taxes. Just throw on some more spending. And I'm sorry, I don't want to reopen the budget agreement because I think the constraints on spending are helpful. There have been some things that have broken it. I think the bank problems and some of these have been extraordinary. But if we redo that agreement, you're going to see a windfall of spending programs, and it's constraining us in our budgeting, and it constrains Congress in its spending. So I'm just not going to revisit it.
And a problem, sir, to be constrained like that in terms of trying to deal with new problems that have arisen.
Yes, it's a problem, but it helps you deal with an old problem that has plagued us for years: constraining federal spending. But sure it is. I mean, what president wouldn't like to have a free, open wallet just to give money for every good cause that comes along? A lot of people would like that. There's a lot of problems in this country, some of which would require more money. But there also is a responsibility here to try to hold the line on excessive spending. And that is where the budget agreement comes into effect. Yes, Ann.
Mr. President, considering your concern about propriety in government, what was your reaction when a senior member of your White House staff, Ed Rogers, left the White House employ and signed a contract with the Saudi sheik accused of being a key figure in the BCCI scandal?
Well, he is a free citizen to do anything he wants once he leaves the White House. My concern is about the White House itself, that it be beyond any perception of impropriety.
Well, what do you think he was selling to the Saudis except for access?
Ask him. I don't know what he's selling. I don't know anything about this man except I've read bad stuff about him, and I don't like what I read about him. But I would suggest that matter is best dealt with by asking this man what kind of representation he is doing for this sheikh. But it has nothing to do, in my view, with the White House.
Even though he left here only 3 weeks before and had never had a job in private industry before.
Well, and suppose you left here and went out into the private sector for some company, and you'd been in editing and in writing all your life, and you started off. I don't know that it would be the function of the president to suggest what employment somebody should take. If you ask me, would I like to go out there and leave my job and go to work for this sheikh when I get through being president? No, I wouldn't like to do that. Yeah.
Washington has seen something of a bidding war this week on tax cuts, started by some of the meetings you've had here with Republicans. Has the bidding war ended? Have you been able to shut it down? And the second question is, if any kind of tax cuts can't break the budget deal, doesn't that make it a non-starter?
Give me the first part again.
Well, have you shut the bidding war down?
Well, I don't think we can shut it down. I think it's understandable when you have a bad economic numbers come in from time to time, mixed, I must happily say, with some reasonably good ones, other people get concerned. I'm concerned. But I don't want to say to them, well, you shouldn't come forward with proposals, but I don't want to participate in a bidding war. We've got some good proposals up there. Some are being attacked, I think, rather unfairly, for pure political reasons. Things that would have stimulated the economy long before now. And I don't need to repeat those six again, but if you'd like me to, I will. But nevertheless, I really do think that these are things that would stimulate jobs and stimulate growth and new business formation. And Congress wants to try some other approach. They are not together in their act. I'll look at the processes. I will keep in mind whether they bust the budget agreement or not, and then I'll make some determination and might well come out with something, a new combination of what I think is best. Maybe I should do that. But it doesn't trouble me that people are concerned about the state of the economy as they see it, are concerned when people are out of work. Of course they should be concerned. So I can't criticize someone for his or her proposal as to what to do up there.
As long as the price for a cut in the capital gains tax, from the Democrats' perspective, is going to be a hike in rates or some form of rate alignment, it's got to be a non-starter from your perspective.
Well, I've proposed a capital gains cut with no income tax increases, and I like that idea. I don't want to be out there again getting caught up in some meat grinder on taxes again. And I don't think the American people want to have their taxes raised again, whether lower income, middle income, or higher income. There's an awful lot of discomfort in this country about higher taxes. A lot of people think we ought to be doing a better job on controlling spending. It's one of the reasons I don't want Congress to bust the budget agreement. So we're going to stay on this. Anything I propose will have real growth to it. The other point for the economic reporters here and those that concentrate on that is, let's be sure what we do helps. Let's be sure it helps in timely fashion. And that's a key point. What's needed? What will help? And I'm trying to sort that through with the best economic advice I can get. Yeah.
Mr. President, there were published...
Plural?
Yes. Okay, good
point. No, did you say questions? All right.
There were published reports that you personally approved the campaign by Republican senators to discredit Anita Hill. Marlin said that was not true. Whether that was true or not...
It wasn't true. Let me just stop you right there. It was not true. Now, go ahead.
Did you condone the Republican tactics? And if you didn't, as the head of the Republican Party and President of the United States, why didn't you stop it?
What tactics are you talking about, please?
There were a lot of critics of the Republican senators who...
No, I'm not one of those.
Who led a campaign to discredit Anita Hill's testimony.
Well, the question, testimony, raised certain questions in the minds of the American people, who overwhelmingly supported Clarence Thomas, incidentally, right at the end, as well as along the way. I think it's appropriate to inquire about that testimony.
Did you have any problems with the kinds of questions they asked, or the innuendo that there were other things there that they could not bring
up? I had problems with the whole thing. I gave a speech yesterday on my problems, which I think are the problems the American people had with the whole process. Because, you see, I think those graphic... X-rated charges, no matter whether they prove true or not, should be done in behind closed doors. I think the American people have a right to know, but they also have a right to delegate. And in my view, Joe Biden was right at the very beginning of his of the whole hearings when he suggested that the witnesses could be accommodated behind closed doors. That's the way I'd like to have seen the matter resolved. And I don't think the American people would be any worse off for it, nor would Clarence Thomas or Anita Hill be any worse off for it. They'd be better off for it.
Did you think she was treated fairly?
I don't want to accuse Senator Biden of not running a fair hearing. I've said in the very beginning, I thought that he did a good job on that. And so please don't try to draw me into what was fair and not. Some people were disappointed in the results. They might not think it was fair. I was pleased with the results because I think the American people's confidence in this judge has been proved to be correct. Yeah.
Albeit you believe Anita Hill was not telling the truth and your nominee was, are you concerned at all, Mr. Bush, that three women who were scheduled to testify about the so-called glass ceiling...
No, not concerned about that.
Even though they said the treatment of Anita Hill was what persuaded them they should not go public and criticize their employers in public?
Look, there's a lot of people on all sides bubbling around out there in moments of discontent. I think the country's glad to have the matter resolved. I think it resolved itself satisfactorily in terms of the end result. Clarence Thomas being on the bench. I think I was vastly persuaded by his points about what had happened to him and his family as a result of this. So renewing it, or if the question is, do I think it should have been extended so three other people could come forward? No, I don't think so.
This is a separate hearing in which three women refused to testify about another area of job discrimination, saying that what they considered the public flaying of Anita Hill reflected what might happen to them if they were.
Yes, I am. Excuse me, I missed your point. Yes, I am concerned about that. I'm concerned about good people who might want to come otherwise be attracted to government won't come forward to come into government because they themselves don't want to be possibly put through that kind of a meat grinder. Yes, I am very much concerned about that.
Excuse me, Mr. Bush, these were women who were already in government who said previous to Anita Hill's testimony that they had suffered job discrimination because they were women. Following her testimony and treatment by the Judiciary Committee, they refused to testify in public for fear of similar treatment, even though there may have been legitimacy to their claims, which you claim was not the case with Anita Hill. What I'm asking is, are you worried about a chilling effect?
Please, you're putting words in my mouth. I didn't claim anything such thing, but go ahead.
Are you worried about a possible chilling effect?
Yes, I just said so. Yes, I am worried about a chilling effect. The more of that kind of open, flamboyant debate where people's characters on one side or another get attacked, I worry about it. And I addressed myself to that in a speech yesterday and had some suggestions about it. And one of them I don't think I specifically made there. I think you ought to have more executive sessions when it comes to this or comes to hearings people's constraints so they can come forward. Yes, I do worry about that. Yeah.
Sir, you campaigned in Louisiana for Buddy Romer. And what is your political analysis of the kind of climate that would produce the number of votes that came in for a former Klan leader and a Nazi sympathizer, David Duke, who claims to be a Republican?
Well, I don't know. I didn't follow the issues that much down there to know why people that voted for him did that. Want to be positioned in that I could not possibly support David Duke because of the racism and because of the very recent statements that are very troubling in terms of bigotry and all of this. Having said that, I can't help you on the other questions that obviously influenced a lot of very plain, honest, decent voters down there. But there's a discontent amongst a lot of voters, and maybe he touched a chord on that. Having said that, to the degree it was attractive to voters because of race or bigotry, I would denounce that vigorously.
Would your repudiation go so far as to advise the people of Louisiana to vote for his opponent or perhaps write in another name?
Well, I already supported Buddy Romer, and I don't know how the rules work down there in that at all. But I am very unhappy that the governor was not renominated here or got into the runoff. I'm very unhappy about that because I still feel that he's a very reasonable man, forward-looking man, and good man. But I'm not going to inject myself in here except to say that we can never in any way support David Duke for the reasons I gave. And so please don't try to draw me into a runoff in that state. I'm not going to be so drawn.
Yeah, one more. Sir.
Yeah, this is the last one.
Are you going to be in a position in Madrid at the meeting with President Gorbachev to answer some of his proposals about nuclear weapons with proposals of your own?
No.
If not, what are you going to talk about?
Well, open-ended. We're going there as the Matrix is a peace conference for the Middle East, but I'm sure we'll discuss bilateral issues, and I'll be prepared to discuss nuclear weapons. I'll be prepared to discuss their economy and ours. I'll be prepared to discuss anything that he's interested in. We always have a wide-ranging discussions, and I'm looking forward to that part of this very, very much. But the reason I was so quick is I don't want to leave the impression that we're coming forth with a new 4-point program or 6-point program in response to his positive response to our initiative. Let me end this press conference by Ellen. Last one. All right. I did recognize you earlier. I'm sorry, but this is it now, really.
There are some some people, sir, who think that the message from the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearing, the message to women is, don't bother to come forward on sexual harassment because you won't be believed. Sir, do you believe that is a message, or would you tell the American women that they should come forward?
I say they should come forward, but let's do it in a climate so people are not destroyed in the process. And that's why I'm saying let's do it behind closed doors, or let's have procedures that you don't leak information that Anita Hill gave that she asked be confidential, and then somebody goes out and insidiously leaks it, and she's drawn into a public debacle that she didn't want in the first place. Yes, I'm concerned about that, and her feelings and everything else related to it. And I've made proposals that I think would help, including the way we handle FBI reports. So when people can't come forward for fear of their character being damaged and being dragged through the mud, of course I worry about it. And that's why I styled some proposals yesterday that I think will help address the problem. Whether they'll solve it or not, Ellen, I don't know. And I repeat, it's true for not just women coming forward on a sex harassment case or to back up Anita Hill, but it's true for people that might otherwise come into government. And they don't want to be dragged into these kinds of disclosures that go after their character. And I don't know how we solve the problem entirely, but I have made some suggestions that I think will help.
Why, sir, shouldn't women now be concerned that their character will be damaged by coming forward, understanding that most sex harassment hearings are not on film?
Well, why should a nominee not be concerned that his character will be blasted, as Judge Thomas's was? You're putting it on one basis. You're putting it on the feminist basis. Yes, I'm concerned about that, and I've made proposals to do something about it. I'm also concerned on a public service basis, and in this instance, I was very much concerned about the character assassination of Clarence Thomas, that there's a way to handle these things. You delegate intelligence matters. Why can't you delegate without the people having a right to know every detail? Why can't you delegate in the hearings the judgment on these matters to the senators to do behind closed doors? And why can't we facilitate the process by guaranteeing as best we can against insidious leaks that damage people the minute the door opens? And so I've made some proposals on that, and yes, I'm concerned, but I don't want to end on a downer note here. I want to end by saying I can't tell you how pleased I am about this civil rights vote. I have taken, some people have said, well, the president may not really want a civil rights bill. He wants an issue of some sort. My political opponents charging that over and over again. And the fact now that we have a good, strong, reasonable civil rights bill, I think it's good for the American people. I think it transcends party politics, and I salute Bob Dole and Jack Danforth on our side and others on the Democratic side who have been willing to work in a constructive fashion, ups and downs in the negotiating process, charge and countercharge. But today we have a good civil rights bill, and I'd like to ask the Senate to promptly pass it without change, and I'd like to ask the House to accede to it, and let's do something that's good and upright in the field of civil rights for the American people. Thank you very much.
Senator Mitchell, are you happy with the compromise reached on the civil rights bill?
Oh, yes, I am. It's what we wanted all along. It's essentially restoring to the law the standard that was created by the Supreme Court in 1971, was the law for 18 years, and then it was reversed by the current court in 1989. And this effectively reverses or overrides the 89 court decision and reinstates the prior law. It's really what we wanted all along. We could have had this a year and a half ago had the president agreed then to what he's agreed to now.
So you are anticipating at this time that it will have the support that it needs from your party to pass in the House and the Senate?
Well, certainly. It's what we've wanted all along. It's getting the support of the Republicans that has been achieved in this process.
Well, one major point of contention was, before the compromise came up, was the ability of women to collect damages in the case of discrimination. How exactly will this work? There's been a lot of talk about caps.
Yes. Under current law, they cannot receive damages. This provides damages to a limited degree. Most Democrats wanted no caps on the damages for women, but President Bush insisted that there be caps, and therefore the compromise does provide some caps, greater than what's permissible under current law, less than what we would have preferred, but that was part of the compromise. So the president did prevail on imposing caps on women. He insisted on that. We agreed to that. However, we're going to undertake a separate effort now, separate legislation, to deal with that, and we hope to have that up in this Congress.
Would you have gotten as much as you wanted had it not been for the Thomas confirmation hearings?
I think it's a combination of the Thomas hearings and the David Duke election. I think that the president has obviously retreated from his prior position, and this is just giving him a fig leaf for that retreat. I think the Duke election in the runoff in Louisiana was the inevitable consequence of the racial policies of the Reagan and Bush administration. And I think it's become clear that they overplayed their hand in that. The possibility existed for an override of the president's veto on this bill. And the combination of his overplaying racial politics and having his veto overridden caused him to change his mind and accept now what he's been unwilling to accept for the past year and a half.
What kind of feedback or reaction are you getting from civil rights groups on this bill?
Well, obviously, they would have preferred that it had been done a long time ago.
Does it go far enough for them, though?
Well, I think most will be satisfied that we get a bill. The alternative would be a continuing fight and the pot not certain of a bill. This way we get this issue behind us, and I hope we begin the healing process and we'll have an end to the racial politics that has been so dominant beginning in the 1988 presidential election campaign and continuing until now. I think that's a very important achievement, as Senator Kennedy noted, that we end this divisiveness and hope that there'll be no more racial politics from the White House in this regard.
Thank you for being here, ladies and gentlemen. Today we dedicate a building to a master builder, if you will. I have no doubts whatsoever that if John Hanna had continued in the Michigan State presidency for just a few more years, the site of this building would have probably been just in the middle of the Michigan State University campus. Because you see, I'm convinced that John and Jack Breslin would have kept squaring off the campus into downtown Lansing and beyond. After all, their fundraising staff already was housed here downtown. It was called the state legislature. But let there be no doubt, ladies and gentlemen, when the history of the 20th century higher education is written, the revolution that occurred along the banks of the Red Cedar will be very, very central to that saga. John Hanna's university declared that the global village was upon us. It declared, perhaps for the first time, that true elitism in American higher education must involve feeding the hungry, curing the affirmed, nurturing the soil, and serving the less fortunate. Led by John Hanna, with a beautiful lady at his side, Sarah Hanna, Michigan State College grew in ways that most people said at that time were impossible. It went from being provincial to being universal, if you will. Yes, when the history of 20th century higher education is finally written, it will focus on the men and the women who led the march to excellence in both public and in private education. Leading that parade, history will absolutely show, were two men, dear friends and allies in an important cause. And anyone, ladies and gentlemen, who thinks a poultry farmer and a priest is an unlikely alliance doesn't know much about higher education and public service in the second half of the 20th century. While still in their 30s, these two men both became presidents of their alma maters, small, relatively undistinguished Midwestern colleges. They were very safe choices to head their secure campuses, proven managers who would surround themselves with very good people. They'd follow the book, everyone said, for the 6 years or so that they'd both be presidents. Well, ladies and gentlemen, all that poultry farmer and priest did was serve combined tenures as presidents of those two colleges for more than 60 years. All the poultry farmer and priest did was revolutionize public and private higher education in the United States. And I must advise, they didn't exactly follow the book. Let's face it, Hannah and Hesburgh rewrote the book. And American higher education was forever transformed in the process. To be sure, the college presidency was dramatically changed by these two men, perhaps more than by any other college presidents in the second half of their century. Dr. John Hanna and Father Ted Hesburgh proclaimed that university presidents must be seen and heard wherever they might have impact and influence. And boy, were those two seen and heard, loud and clear. Too loud and too clear for some, I might add. There they were, on the Civil Rights Commission together, in the halls of Congress together, at the White House together, at the Pentagon together, on foreign soil together. I'd like to ask, with slight modification and poetic license, a riddle that they used to ask in Indiana. What was the difference between God, John Hanna, and Ted Hesburgh in the 50s and 60s? The answer, of course, was God, as always, was everywhere. Hanna and Hesburgh were everywhere but on their campuses. And often they were AWOL together, whether it be in Washington, D.C., or in Montgomery, Alabama, in Jackson, Mississippi, or in Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin. Ladies and gentlemen, together they rocked the boat. They made waves. And more importantly, the two of them made history. They placed the American university at the service of the people. They made justice and civil rights and human dignity and tolerance part of the living curriculum. Friends, this very wonderful facility in Lansing, Michigan, will be a monument to the great John Hanna. But John Hanna's life itself was a monument that will endure long after bricks and mortar crumble away. Yes, as I said at John's eulogy in February, he talked with presidents and kings, but he walked with students and farmers. John Hanna lived and he died in the 20th century. But John Hanna will live on in the 21st century. Whenever people speak of liberation from ignorance, from poverty, from injustice, and from intolerance. John Hanna was truly a great, great educator. More importantly, he was a great public service. And above all, he was a very great man. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we honor him, but his life and his example honor us. Thank you very much. I just said that John Hanna had a partner in many of his efforts and achievements. It is my very distinct honor to introduce a man whose assessment of John Hanna was included in John's eulogy. He said, John was a good man, a great friend, one I admired and loved. Ladies and gentlemen, John Hanna's friend and colleague on the Civil Rights Commission and in the history books, and one of my two great heroes in life, Father Ted Hesburgh, President Emeritus of University of Notre Dame.
Mr. Governor, President DiBiagio, God will forgive you for all of that stretching of the truth. There's a wonderful saying that would be in the language of Dante, se non è vero e ben trovato. It may not be true, but it certainly sounds wonderful. John, I appreciate very much your kind words. And I must say that it's like old times to be teamed up in harness with the president of Michigan State University again, as John and I try to wrestle with the problems of intercollegiate athletics together all around the country. And I think we're gaining on them. And I think we're going to have a much better intercollegiate athletic picture when the Knight Commission's report is legislated at the NCAA, National Collegiate Athletic Association. I'm here today squeezing in a quick visit here between school, where I am occasionally, change laundry, and a meeting in Greenwich, Connecticut tonight, to which I'm probably going to be late. But the fact is that nothing normal could keep me away from being here today on this wonderful occasion. One thing that John said that is very true is that I love John Hanna. And he was more than just a companion in arms. He was a mentor, and a little older than I am, he was a father. And I knew when I met his family, that beautiful woman Sarah, and his sons and their daughter. And I saw that family hung together, and they all looked you in the eye and had a firm grip in their hands that they were true sons of John and Sarah, and that he was perhaps most honored in his family. But then I had much to do with him here at the university. And he did indeed take what was not very well known as a university and make it into one of the greatest universities in this land. We used to have a little game, because I was on the National Science Board, and every month we would have meetings and give out grants. And I would always sneak out at the end of the session and call up John Hanna and say, John, University of Michigan got $259,000 a day, you got $432,000, and he'd say, all right. It was a great rivalry there, but you had to have facts to prove it. Another thing that we really will never forget is one day he called up my predecessor, John Kavanaugh, who was from Owosso, Michigan. And they were both John, so he said, John, this is John. I've got a proposition to put to you. He said, we're never going to really get known around here until we're in the Big Ten, and there are all kinds of forces keeping us out of the Big Ten. But if we can only play Notre Dame, we'll be in the big time, and they won't be able to keep us out of the Big Ten. A lot of bigs in that sentence. Anyway, he said, I'm willing to give you a 10-year contract to play Michigan State. You can keep 60% of the money, and we'll even come down to Notre Dame every year if that's what you want. And John Kavanaugh said, John, that's not a very good deal. First of all, 10 years is too long. Let's make it 5. 60-40 isn't fair. Let's make it 50-50, and as far as coming down here, let's make it home and home. And we've been on that basis just about ever since. And it's been a great association, and I think it has linked us together in so many other ways that I am so proud of this institution of which I have an honorary doctorate, so I feel I'm at home here. Of course, I played it safe. I'm at home at the University of Michigan, too. But let me say that I can't think of anything nicer, apart from the building in his name at the University of Michigan State. I can't think of anything nicer than here in the capital of this great state of Michigan to have something that will bear John Hanna's name. Because John Hanna was not just president of Michigan State. I totted up the other day the number of years I've spent on government commissions and jobs of one kind or another for the president or the Congress. And it came out to about 60 years. I think John's would even be higher than that, because John and I served on about the same number, but he served longer on some of them. But he always served with distinction. I'll never forget the first day we met across from the White House in a little building on Jackson Square, Lafayette Park. And we came into a small room, the six of us on the commission had just been sworn in at the White House. It was January the 2nd, 1958. And we had there in this little dusty room a table with six chairs around it where we were seated, a pile of mail literally this high, unopened mail, which were complaints on the civil rights abuses in this country. And at that particular time, we had less than $1 million in budget out of Eisenhower's emergency budget. We had problems that were incredible. 6 million blacks who couldn't even register to vote. We had states, 13 states, where there wasn't a single black youngster from kindergarten to high school to college to graduate school to professional schools. Not one in any of the state institutions paid for by public money in the Morrill Act. There were 25 things at least that a black person couldn't do in our society, which was a constant insult and a constant disgrace to this nation, who claim that these rights are inalienable. They don't come from the state, but from God. And they include the rights of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. John believed that deeply, and he really gave a good chunk of his life to making it come true. We knew we had problems in education, we had problems in housing, we had problems certainly in employment. There were only a few miserable tasks that blacks would be hired to do. We also knew that this constant disgrace in public accommodation could not go on, where a black couldn't even go to church on Sunday if it was a white church, or go swimming on a public beach, or go into any restaurant and get a meal. These things were wrong, and John knew they were wrong. I'd have to say, and I'm sure Bob will back me up on this, that John was no flaming liberal. But by golly, he did believe in basic human rights. And especially when we met together, as we did for hundreds of days, all across this land, in New Orleans several times, in Houston, in Dallas, in San Antonio, in Miami, Florida, in Phoenix, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in New York, in Boston, in Chicago, and Detroit too. We met in all of these places and spent days listening to poor people tell us how they were being treated. And John just said, by God, this is not going to continue. And we put out over 100 volumes, and we put out legislation proposed from what we had heard. We said, this is what we have heard. These are our conclusions. These are our recommendations for new law. And believe it or not, this man who was supposed to be a poultry farmer led the way to get 77% of those very controversial proposals passed into federal law in the Omnibus Civil Rights Act of 1964, in the Voting Act of 1965, and the Housing Act of 1968. These were measures that will last forever. These measures changed the face of America from a shameful face to a bright and shining face. Changed it overnight when those laws were passed. And John was leading the struggle, leading the fight, and I was proud to be standing there alongside of him. I think it's important that in a unit of government such as this, in the state capitol, there be something to recognize this man who did so many different tasks. I only mentioned the one that I was with him on for 11 years, and he went from that one to the relief for the whole world, the Agency for International Development, and that's when I became chairman, and I had a hard time following in his footsteps. You would never think of John as a literary critic, but I can go remember the days we turned out those reports, and our staff would come in full of ebullience with these reports and say, the miserable situation cries to heaven for its response in a glittering injustice. And John would say, you know, it says the same thing if you say the situation cries to heaven because it's unjust. You don't need all those adjectives. You don't need all those adverbs. Just let the miserable facts speak for themselves. That will convince people. Otherwise, you're trying to snow them. That was John's practical, down-to-earth kind of way. And he was a bearcat on making sure the facts were facts. And in fact, we were not, in all of those 100 books, ever caught short on a single fact that wasn't a fact. They were all true. And they all stood up. And they all did the job they were supposed to do. And as I say, John led the way. I think of another intertwining that most of you never heard of, probably. One day they called up John Kavanaugh, again my predecessor as president, and said, we'd like you to be Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower because you're in a university and you know how to handle people. And John said, well, I don't think I really should do it. I don't think a priest should be in that job. But there's a great guy up just north of me here named John Hanna. And John Hanna was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower, Associate Secretary. So we've been tied together in many ways, and I've learned much from this man. I admire him deeply. I pray for the repose of his dear soul and that of Sarah every day. But I'm delighted in this sunshiny day in the presence of the governor and one of his successors, in fact, three of his successors here, Walter and Cecil. I'm so happy to be able to stand here and say I was proud to know him. I was proud to learn from him in so many ways. And I'm especially proud today to stand here while the governor dedicates this building by executive order to the name of John Hanna. And this is a proud name in the history of this state. I think it's a proud name in the history of this country and of this world. I was with John in Okinawa and in Philippines and many other places. I think this was a man of all seasons, but he was also a man of all parts of the earth. And wherever he went, he brought justice, he brought hope, he brought things that would help mankind live a better life. Governor, you've got a great state and a great state capital, a gorgeous building here, and you're going to put a very proud name on it, and I'm happy to be associated with you in doing this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to have Dr. Hesburgh with us today, and President DiBiagio, and President Mackey, and President Adams, as Father Hesburgh said, the predecessors or successors to John Hanna, and geriatric 6+1 over there. Thank you for a job well done. And from the Hanna family, I note that there have been several references to Bob, but it's Bob Hanna, the son of John, and John's granddaughter, and I'm not Rachel, and Bob, will the family, the Hanna family, stand up, please? We'll welcome you, and thank you very much. It's a ironic time, actually. Here we are on the eve of the big game. I look around the audience, and I see people from all the universities of Michigan, including the other university down in Ann Arbor, and serving on the Hanna Committee, people like Cliff Taylor, who helped put this day together. And I think the ultimate tribute to John Hanna is the fact that he bridged all gaps. He went everywhere, and he reached out to people from all the world, all the countries, and in this state of ours, Bob Waldron said that, former Speaker of the House, when he took office as Speaker, he had an image, probably due to his education, received elsewhere, of Michigan State University and the President John Hanna, but over time he said he became one of the great admirers. And today we've got a letter from the President of the University of Michigan, and I want to share it with you because it's a nice set of sentiments. So, dear colleagues, it has been a great privilege to participate in this project to honor John Hanna, one of the great leaders in the history of American higher education. Under President Hanna's strong and visionary leadership, Michigan State University became not only one of the great public universities in the world, but perhaps our nation's leading model of the land-grant university, reaching out to serve the society which supported it. My own acquaintance with and high regard for President Hanna goes back to my own college days before I ever came to Michigan. I played college football with his son, Bob, quite literally, side by side, since I was right tackle and he was right end. Well, that's a little-known trivia fact, Bob, that I didn't know. So. Jim Duderstadt says that my respect for President Hanna grew as stronger as I learned more about his remarkable accomplishments during my years on the faculty at the University of Michigan. It gives me the greatest pleasure to convey on behalf of the University of Michigan our admiration and esteem for President Hanna. The dedication of this facility to him is an appropriate tribute to his accomplishments and to the extraordinary contributions he has made to our state and to our nation. And that's Jim Duderstadt on behalf of the University of Michigan and his capacity as President of the Council of University Presidents for the State of Michigan. So we thank him for that. There's another fact about John Hanna that's probably appropriate. As we look towards Saturday, some people think it overshadows all else. I said to John B. DiBiagio earlier, he's succeeding in making Michigan State a more of an academic-oriented university. He disclaimed credit for that, but in the Hanna years, the record President DiBiagio was 17 wins and 14 losses in that game. Now, just a historical footnote, those were the days. Now, my own experience, and everybody has a story, and the committee that helped put this together, Gene Wanger, we had quite a group of people that were part of that, and we wanted Jack Shingleton. We had quite a few people that helped to make this day possible, and in fact, actually suggested the idea. But my own memories go back to 1960s, and I was on the campus at Michigan State at the time, the president of East Shaw Hall, and President Hanna had a great way with the students as well. As student leaders, we were from time to time invited over to the president's house for, in this case, it was a dinner. He'd have all the administrators around the different tables and give us a chance to ask questions and to give a little bit of an update on what was happening with the university. And I remember the sort of the heady experience of walking into the president's house as about a sophomore at Michigan State at the time and having that exposure to this giant of a man. And it was obvious then that his compassion, his intellect, and a devotion to public service that's been discussed this morning, and his devotion to Michigan State University. It's easy to see why so many thousands of students were influenced by his leadership. And this year, I had the opportunity to address the graduating class at the Michigan State University, and I said at the time about John Hanna, when I announced that we would honor him by putting his name on this building and dedicating the building which houses the Department of Education to him, that John Hanna was a person whose hand was firm, his vision was unlimited, and his compassion heartfelt. That John Hanna changed the face of Michigan. And he really did. He changed Michigan, and he changed the world because of many things, but primarily because he understood the importance of education. And it's our challenge to follow in his legacy and to grasp that mantle of leadership that he held for so long and to change our state again. It's my hope that this building that we're naming today, through our dedication, that parents and the educators, employees of state government, university presidents and governors, people across this great state of ours, remember the contributions of John Hanna, join us in changing our schools and our education system for the better. You know, this building has been here a while, but this is an opportunity today to rededicate it, and as we rededicate it to the memory of John Hanna, we dedicate it to the memory of someone who, in everything that he did, stood for excellence. I enjoyed the comments of Father Hesburgh about President Hanna's preoccupation with the facts. Get the facts right. And the facts are very important today, and sometimes we wish to ignore them and wish they weren't so, but John Hanna accepted things the way they were and then said, I'm going to change it and make it better. I'm going to improve it so tomorrow we benefit from changed conditions. And that's true in education or civil rights, poverty and hunger around the world, everything that he did. And so as we think of the memories of Hanna and this building which will bear his name in our state, our challenge is in education and our children. I hope that we're up to that task. I think we are. And Father Hesburgh, we're so honored that you could join us today. We know you made a special effort to be here to participate, and it's very clear that you hold a special place in your heart for John Hanna and special understanding and knowledge of this man that we honor. Together, as John DiBiagio said, Father Hesburgh and John Hanna helped America and the world understand the best way to achieve justice and peace in the world is through education. And so we thank you, and again, want to thank the committee for the continuing commitment that you've made, not only in this event today, but ongoing, to honor the memory and continue the legacy of John Hanna. And it's now my privilege to sign Executive Order 1991-26, which takes effect immediately and renames the South Ottawa Tower, a name that I'm sure we'll forget quickly as it becomes the John A. Hanna Building. And I'll do that at the moment. Thank you.